Hi, and welcome to Saturday Supercast, Episode 2. Today we've got an hour of comics talk with Mark Rudolph, the creator of Curse of the Pharaohs and contributor on the Galactic League of Marshals. We also take a few minutes to talk about his theories on creation and some of the comics he creates over at cvcomics.com. Enjoy!
Hey, wake up, it's another beautiful day. Sit down, cause it's time for the best breakfast. And all your friends are here to stay.
Hi, and welcome to Saturday Supercast. Today we're talking with Mark Rudolph. Mark Rudolph is the artist and writer of Curse of the Pharaohs, the upcoming Sugary Cereals anthology. He's also the artist behind CVComics.com, which stands for Control Voice Comics, where you can find comics such as Mulligan's Run, Satan's Slugs, Closing Doors. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start off by just talking about what you're doing for Sugary Cereals, what your upcoming piece is called, Curse of the Pharaohs. What can you tell us about it besides the pages that we've seen on the website?
Oh, basically it's going to be a kind of an interdimensional, intergalactic, ancient struggle of good versus evil kind of thing, all centered around, loosely centered around, Egyptian iconography and, myth and mummies and, things like that. And basically, it's going to be kind of in a roundabout way, it's going to be this kid kind of coming into his own and, the typical get some responsibility, great power, great responsibility, little Spider-Man, little Johnny Quest, little everything.
Coming of age thing.
Yeah.
And, the kid's, our vehicle into the story.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah. He's your surrogate, I think this is the fancy writer's term for that. Okay, so this is that dumb question that everybody always asks, but I think it's worth asking. Where the heck did that mummies? Where did that come from? Mummies at the county fair kind of thing is what I'm seeing in the pages here. What was the inspiration for that? Was there anything, or was it just I like mummies?
Well, there's always that weird, older carnivals had this weird, it was either a mix between the freak shows or they had some kind of odd, come and see the eighth wonder of the world, they'd have a stuffed goat with a pig head on it or something, and just the weirdness. I figured it was believable to have something like this happen, just kind of a strange backdrop, and set it kind of in a timeless, more of a 50s, 60s era, but you can't really tell for sure if that's where it's from, and that just kind of, I just figured that, and then mummies, because zombies are kind of passe anymore. And well, I think mummies, there's a lot you can do with them. Plus, they don't really play super heavily into the story, but
they're definitely there as your monster,
yeah,
as your threat. I mean, you can
they'll be the disposable, evil force that will be in later stories as well. So,
right, yeah, it's a good monster. It's been used very effectively in the past. So yeah, I can see that.
And they all look like Mumra.
I was going to ask about that. You are a child of the 80s, and this is something I want to kind of attack about talking about your style, because you definitely have, more than any of the other Sugary Cereals artists, you have a more, what I would call, I wouldn't even call it retro, it's more old-timey style. Retro, I think, refers to maybe 20 years ago, but this is further back than that. And what's interesting about that, to me, is you grew up, your formative years as an artist was during the Image days, and yet here you are with this kind of more older throwback style. Now, we know that, as a child of the 80s, obviously your story influences would be a lot of cartoons that kind of are the inspiration for a lot of Sugary Cereals, Thundercats, G.I. Joe,
Voltron,
all that stuff. But what I want to talk about, or what I'm curious about, rather, is how did you develop, growing up in the 90s, as a teen in the 90s, how in the world did you grow up and wind up having a more older, I would say, late 60s, early 70s kind of Marvel DC style? Where was the beginning of that? Do you remember?
I'm trying to, because I didn't, for the longest time, I didn't even think about, you know, what I was doing. I was just trying to emulate, you know, the flavor of the month or whatever. But I think there's a good maybe 6-7 year gap where I didn't really draw many comics, but I was still reading and like researching older things and getting really into film. I don't know if that informed, but I've always had this weird draw to, you know, anything old, pretty much, like, well, you know, old film, old comics, books, you know, just things of the 30s, some stuff that looks like well worn and well lived in. And I really don't know where that.
Well, maybe to just
that came from.
I'll just draw my recollections, because we grew up around each other, mm-hmm. and I specifically remember at the height of Liefeld's popularity, and McFarlane's popularity. We're talking about Todd McFarlane, Rob Liefeld, Will Spartaccio, Jim Lee, all those guys. For those of you listeners out there who don't know, we're talking about Wikipedia. You'll find them in 1991, 92. These guys were, everybody was trying to emulate them. I remember all of our friends who drew at that time were trying to be Rob Liefeld, or at least some semblance of Rob Liefeld. And yet, I distinctly remember one of your guiding influences at that time, in the comics you were drawing at that time, was mm-hmm. Sal Buscema. Yep. And Sal Buscema is about as anti-image as you can get as far as, like, flash and glitter and storytelling. He's on the other end of the spectrum, where I would classify him as more of a storyteller with less of a flashy style than the image guys. So it just strikes me as odd that your guiding star would be so far on the other side. What was it about Sal Buscema's stuff? I'm thinking about like Sal Buscema, John Buscema, some of the other ones from that period, from the 70s that were really.
I mean, even guys like, you know, Brett Blevins, I can see some of that kind of coming in, like the dynamicism that he had, like, compared to everybody else at the time. He was more about form than, you know, style, I could say. But.
And I would say that in both the case of Brett Blevins and Sal Buscema, you have a looser inking style.
Yeah.
And less of a polished style. So is that what was attractive to you about it? I mean, what was it? Can you formulate what, like, can you remember when you were that age and, like, what it was that really grabbed you?
I think some
you?
Of it came to, like, impatience, too. Like, I could do something really technical and really precise, but I ended up losing all the energy in my drawings, I think.
Mm.
So I think some of it has to do with just being lazy and wanting to do, you know, instant gratification kind of thing. I mean, some of that came from Frank Miller as well, like back, you know, his early Sin City stuff. It was really heavy blacks. I got really into doing that, you know, all kinds of like lighting. And also at the same time, I started getting into Joe Kubert, which is about one of the loosest inkers there is out there. So
yeah, definitely. Okay, I can see that. So, but aside from, well, I'm glad that you're honest enough to admit that was partially laziness. But I also remember, even at an early age, one of the things that really stood out about your work was a level of energy. And it's interesting that you point out that, like, the more refined stuff that you did would have less energy. I remember, to bring up Todd McFarlane again, something he said once. Oh, gosh, I don't remember where he said it, but he said something about the more steps he creates in his process of creating art, the more stiff the finished product becomes. So he likes to go, I think he was talking about how he goes straight to inks on the page, or he very, very loosely pencils, but in any case, is that something you find is true? Like, the more steps you put in there, the tighter, the more stiff your work becomes?
Oh, I think so. If I could go directly to inks, or if my pencils were to the degree where I could go directly off that, I would, but with my stuff, I think the energy's more in the line than the pose of the character, or the, or even like, I'm trying to think, like, there's not a whole lot of movement physically in the character, maybe. I don't know if this has come across right or not, but it's more of like in the line widths, and I don't know. It's really hard to explain.
That's actually a pretty interesting way of putting it.
Because, like, with your work, you're really, like, your poses, if a guy gets hit, you really feel it. Mm-hmm. You know, you got the guy with his legs, you know, 10 feet apart, you know, punching straight up, and you feel it. And I know, like, a lot, as far, I don't know, it's really, it's an odd.
Well, what's interesting about the way you put that is that you were saying that the energy is more in the craft of delineating the figure rather than the pose of the figure.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's what you're paying attention to is the actual, like, when you watch the way Joe Kubert lays down a brushstroke, that's what's interesting to you. Not whether or not he got his anatomy correct, but you're looking at the energy of the lines themselves. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, to a degree. That's not the only thing.
Sure.
But sometimes I do get hung up on anatomy over, you know, I could have stretched the anatomy a little bit just to get a pose a little bit more dynamic, but...
Yeah.
That's something I'm starting to, right now I'm falling into the trap of trying to make everything anatomically pretty right on. Sometimes that can mud up the works a little bit, but...
Sure. Well, yeah, whenever I'm teaching students about comic art, I say to them that every page presents you with 1,000 choices. What the joy, for me at least, of making comics is with 1,000 choices, you pick your battles. So sometimes the battle's going to be more about anatomy. Sometimes it's going to be more about line value. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's going to be more about overall layout. But the neat thing is there's no right or wrong answer, and it's, you know, everybody has their point of major focus. Like, overall, like, on average, this is what I focus on, and that's what I would guess kind of helps describe your style.
Mm-hmm.
So... Yeah, your style is a lot about ink line work. I would say more so, way more than mine. So, what did you start out with? I mean, what was your progression through tools? Let's talk about that a little bit, because I'm sure young artists are always interested in that.
Yeah.
And I would probably hasten to put a disclaimer on this, is that I don't know if you agree with this or not, but there's no real right or wrong tools for artists.
No, whatever works for you is, I mean, I've struggled with things for, you know, 15 years now, so.
Right.
You know, trying different things, but whatever gets you the desired results, I think is fine, especially in the computer age. You can pretty much use anything you want.
But that said, I mean, I'm sure people would be interested if they want to get to a style that's similar to yours,
mm-hmm.
or if they're inspired by the same kind of people. I'm sure they'd be interested in finding out what your struggles were, where you started, and what tools you landed on, and why you like them.
Well, I remember, I mean, starting out early, it was strictly super dark pencil, but then that progressed to, like, Micron pens, to Sharpies, to felt tips, you know, all the gamut of those kind of tools. And then I finally started, I don't remember exactly, I think it was probably around, like, Sin City era, as I was, like, I read something that Frank Miller used pretty much brushes exclusively. I was like, well, maybe I'll try that. I go to the store, buy, you know, of course, a cheap $6 brush or something. Not very good results. Everything's just flat. You know, you can't get any kind of line value. Kind of the big point was when I spent $35 for a paintbrush, like a Winsor Newton series, I think series 7, number 2, where you can get like a 1-point line or you can get like a 50-point line out of the same thing, and just... over and over trying different things, trying to keep my hand steady, try to do it quickly, try to do it fat or slower, you know, it depends on, I went through 3-4 different kinds of paper, but I've pretty much fallen back, the brush is what I use 90% of the time right now, maybe more than that, 95% of the time. The only thing I don't use it for is real tight, you know, like eyes, little facial features or panel borders.
Oh, I was going to ask that if you did the panel borders.
I tried the panel borders with a dip pen, and that's a nightmare.
<'Cause> like,
you get a great line, and then at the end it spits all over. So
supposedly Walt Simonson uses a Hunt's 102 Crow Quill with a ruler to measure out all of his straight edge stuff.
I can do that kind of, but I'm not willing to risk it. I'd rather just use a normal pen for that.
So that's also worth noting, though, is that you are a traditional pen and ink and paper artist.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the work is done on paper for you.
Yes. Even when it comes to the coloring, most of that's flat colors. I try not to do any effects at all. But I've tried it basically anything that I try to do. If I couldn't do it in a traditional medium, I try to leave it out of my work.
That's just a style issue for you? You just prefer it to look...
Oh, that's kind of my feeling with computers, too. I've even like with layouts, like magazine layouts and stuff I've done in the past, I always try to make... something a little bit imperfect about it. You know, if I have a photo in there that's just like a pristine photo, I'll put, you know, I'll scratch on a piece of paper, scan it in, and just, you know, just to give it a little bit more organic feel. So I do that with my panel borders. I intentionally have some of the borders cross a little bit and don't fix it in Photoshop. As far as an ad or like figures and things, I don't do too many things like that. But as far as like the nuts and bolts of panel borders and dialogue balloons and things like that, I try to have them a little bit skewed.
I think that really helps sell it too. How it helps sell the feel, the makes it more authentically old timey. You know, it also makes me think of, I forget what country this was, but I remember hearing about some maybe it was someplace in Asia, but some rug weavers who intentionally put imperfections into their weavings because to make it perfect is to sort of like compete with the gods or something, or like it'll take your soul or some weird thing.
I think
like that.
Actually like Muslim.
Oh, maybe it's Muslim. Okay. But yeah, it reminds me of that, this notion of perfection is...
I don't know how close to perfection, but...
Well, that makes me wonder, how tight do you pencil? Because you do pencil before you ink, and so how tight do you go?
I'm actually... It's fairly loose. I try to get, based like a good... I mean, a good gauge is if it looks good in silhouette or in profile, you know, that then it looks... That's kind of as far as I go. I get a real rough pencil or... just use a number two and a piece of typing paper, basically. Just kind of get everything, figure out my panel size, go ahead and thumbnail that out, then lightbox it with blue line, kind of a little bit tighter, but not, everything's just sharpened pencils. If I go with mechanical pencils, I just lose something. I don't have the energy. I break leads like crazy, and I pencil really hard.
Yeah, I've seen your pencils, and they are really dark.
Yeah, so I just use, you know, just the sharpened blue line pencil. And then get that onto the board and then go straight to inks. Inks is where all the technique and detail kind of come in.
So penciling is more about setting up structure, pacing, flow.
Yeah, like kind of basically so I don't have any like huge flaws. Like I'm not going to get this, you know, panel all done. I'm going on the arm and all of a sudden like the anatomy is all weird. Mm-hmm. And I've over-rendered it and it looks goofy. So I try to get all those mistakes taken care of in penciling stage.
So is the inking stage, would you describe that as more... That's where you're actually putting your... another thing that I like to... An analogy I'm toying around with right now, and I don't know if it's a good analogy or not, is that if comics is a visual language, then you've got grammar and you've got vocabulary. Mm-hmm. Grammar is where you're thinking about page layout, you're thinking about panel structure, you're thinking about visual pacing, you're thinking about all of the real writerly kind of things that you do when you're doing comic book storytelling. Vocabulary is technique and artistic expression. So what I describe in my workflow is that the grammar all happens in the layout stage when I'm doing like my thumbnails, when I'm loosely penciling a page, and then when I get to the final illustration work, when I'm really doing the detailed pencils and the inking, that's where I'm really showing off how many words are in my vocabulary, so to speak.
Yeah.
All the different line techniques that I know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's all about, you know, that part. You're totally lost in showing off what a great artist you are, whereas the initial stages are showing off how much knowledge you have of the overall craft. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. That's kind of how I am as well. I mean, it's more, not to call it brainless, but it's more kind of like blissfully enjoyable to ink for me than it is to sit there and agonize over pencils. It's not as, I mean, if I have good structure to start with, then I could ink forever.
Right.
But it's a matter of getting, you know, the pencils to the level they need to be and keep the energy and, you know, make sure I'm not going off and, you know.
Yeah, it's not thoughtless to in the final stage, but maybe it's more like, again, to use like really corny analogies, the dancer becomes the dance. You can kind of get lost in the technique.
Yeah, or somebody coming up with like, you know, say music for piano, like actually sitting there dictating it, if you're actually going to do it that way, and then actually playing in it where you get lost in it and you can mm-hmm. do like, you know, little touches that you wouldn't have, you know, just kind of spur the moment improv kind of things. And I do that on a page all the time with different techniques, and sometimes it ends up kind of biting you in the butt. But
that's kind of a good comparison too. It's kind of like a performance, isn't it? It's like that stage of it is kind of like a performance where all the prep work and all the rehearsal has already been done, and now you're showing off to everybody. You're doing you're up in front of the people, showing them what the final result is.
Yeah, I think that's a really good analogy.
Okay. So you've got some other comics coming up on the Sugary Serial site, one of which you're working on with me, called The Galactic League of Marshals. Now, this is your story that we're just kind of teaming up on, so I don't feel uncomfortable interviewing you about this one. Where does this come from? To use the old, tired expression, what was the inspiration?
Well, basically, it's... I mean, I'm sure a lot of you have heard, you know, listen to the podcast, have seen Justice League Unlimited or any kind of like group dynamic, just like really, really well done team comics. Okay. And, you know, having that kind of, you know, like Green Lantern feel, or just like, because I didn't want to do a superhero book, but for some reason lately, I've, you know, probably the last like 5 years, 60s sci-fi has just like really like entranced me for some reason. And this has a lot of, you know, throwbacks to Voltron and that kind of feel as well. But basically, I just wanted to do like a, like some kind of cop slash superhero team kind of book set in space where I could have any kind of supervillain I wanted.
You're really,
and I didn't have to base it on Earth, so I could just draw, you know, space backgrounds.
So it's kind of like fantasy that way, where you can just make up whatever
yeah,
you want.
Yeah, it's like my version of a Tolkien novel.
Right, right, yeah.
That, fantasy.
Yeah, good sci-fi is just like really good fantasy, so, yeah. But you should just let everybody know now that your real inspiration was Space Precinct.
Of course.
That was your favorite show
Space
growing
Precinct
up?
And Alien Nation, the television series.
Those of you who haven't seen Space Precinct, go
do yourself
YouTube.
A favor and yeah.
Go to YouTube now. Run, don't walk. No, but yeah, that's another interesting thing that you know, growing up around you, we were both as youngsters very very into superheroes. Your first comic that you ever did was a superhero comic,
mm-hmm.
And yet you kind of stay away from them now. And so what is it about, like, a sci-fi adventure? Because, I mean, these guys have, like some skin-tight costuming going on a little bit. And even some superheroic aspect in the sense that there's, like, a cat guy and then a gal with this funny headgear on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, her name's Eagle Eye, so that implies that she's some kind of sharpshooter. What is it about taking it to sci-fi that makes it okay? Is there something that
takes it different out of the superhero realm?
Yeah, yeah. What is it that about the superhero realm that keeps you away from it, or rather, what is it about the sci-fi realm that makes doing superhero motifs kind of more more fun for you? I mean, not that there's anything wrong with superheroes.
I think superheroes are fantastic. I mean, most of the stuff, I don't really like a whole lot of contemporary comics, but any of the ones I do, it's usually, you know, superhero based, but they're all, you know, these, you know, characters have been around for 50 years. You know, they've got this huge backstory. Mm-hmm. I just don't feel that I can offer anything to the superhero. As far as a superhero that takes place on Earth present day, there's not really a whole lot in that that really excites me. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything I can do with that. And just sci-fi, the aspect of it, I mean, like, another big influence for this, I mean, is, like, original Star Trek series.
Okay.
Taking that kind of, you know, and the, you know, the whole Jack Kirby thing with nothing's off the table. Any idea is a good idea if done in the through the eye of this of the series. I mean, if it's all, you know, consistent.
Well, I was gonna say like, if you look at Kirby stuff besides what he did with Stan Lee, you look at Challengers of the Unknown, you look at Fourth World. That's just really good sci-fi,
yeah.
More than superhero. I would say
yeah.
Fourth World is more of a sci-fi comic than a superhero comic for the most
part. Oh yeah,
part.
I mean it's like a Bible story.
Yeah, yeah, just like
it's
in outer
huge
space.
Proportions, yeah.
It's got other planets and got yeah. So, I was wondering if that was like part of the influence. I mean, I see right on the preview page on the Sugar Cereal site, the Galactic League panel with the space station there. I see a Jack Kirby crackle behind the space station. So
that's some great. Vocabulary there to use. And it can either pull you through a page, or if you're tired of drawing stars, it can, you know, break it up. It's the nebula. It's the energy. It's
yeah.
I'm not exactly sure what it is.
And you mentioned also that Voltron was an influence, and I'm definitely seeing some inspiration with that the red man there, Julius. He looks like he has some visual heritage from.
Yeah,
guy
he
Prince Lotor.
Kind of come out of the Lotor camp, and the whole relationship between the father and son, you know, that's kind of reflective back of that, you know, Zarkon and Lotor, not quite as the same, but...
Right, right. And I don't know where the heck Gilded Grace came from. That's just is that more of a Star Trek-y kind of influence? Because that's just a weird character altogether. A gal who's encrusted herself with gold because she likes money so much.
I sketched her out. Yeah, I think she was just on the back of a piece of typing paper or something. And and I was just trying to think of names. I think I was coloring her on the computer, and I was like, well, it's got to have alliteration.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what hasn't been done a million times? I don't want to have, like, some, you know, sci-fi type word that has an apostrophe in it or
yeah.
Anything like that.
Ka-chow!
Yeah, just like, I don't know. I was just like, well, it's got good alliteration. You know, she's a... There's not really a whole lot to her, I guess. Which, I mean, I guess you could kind of reflect that in why does she encrust herself in jewels, but
Well,
underpants and a belt, but
we talked about this on the Sugary Cereals podcast that we did episode 16, or not Sugary Cereals podcast, the Make Like a Tree Comics podcast with episode 16 with Sean Robert, where the neat thing about 80s properties specifically, the 80s cartoons we grew up on, was there wasn't a whole lot of depth to the characters, but there was just enough for you to jump off and you know, kind of fantasize about what they would do on their next adventure. So I think that this is a good example of Gilded Grace being like, okay, well, what do we know about her? She's selfish, and she covers herself in gold, so she's obviously not altogether sane. And she apparently
she has an electron whip.
Yeah, she apparently can fight very well. And, yeah, like all good female villains, her weapon is never blunt. It's always something subtle, like a whip or a, I don't know, like some kind of thin sword. Or...
And basically the theory behind all these characters is just like, you know, vibrant four color characters. That's kind of, you know, what I was going for.
Right. Yeah.
You know, the main team, I mean, the main guy, you know, is the kind of bland hero guy, you know, that apparently, you know, everybody can kind of identify with a little bit.
What's the actor you compared him to? Because I thought it was a really good comparison.
John Davidson from That's Incredible.
That's right. And don't forget about his appearance at Edward Scissorhands.
Yes.
Was that his only claim to fame? He probably did some other stuff.
Thought he might have been an athlete.
Was he?
No. Like, he kind of has that Bruce Jenner thing going on, too.
Yeah, he totally does.
Really weird 80s coif hair, but...
But he makes it look good.
Yeah.
We'd look like fools if we had hair like that, but he looks great. So then, yeah, then you got Lieutenant Commander Eagle Eye, who's kind of like the brains and the conscience of the team. Kind of like the Penny to Captain Swift's Inspector Gadget kind of...
Yeah.
...situation.
And Katmandu is basically like a Snake Eyes type character, but, you know... Also peppered a little bit of, you know, ridiculousness where he's a cat. He has cat mannerisms. So
right, yeah.
He doesn't talk. He doesn't really do anything but fight and, like, lick himself or sleep or roll up in a corner or...
Just as long as you don't do the episode where he, like, reveals that he's crazy about lasagna.
No, that would never happen.
So, yeah, and then you've got Dr. Ruby, which is probably one of the most classic names ever for a villain. I mean, that's almost up there with Dr. Evil as far
as,
like...
That's kind of where his... He comes from that same camp of the Captain Action, you know, Dr. Evil villains, where, you know, the guy had an open shirt, sandals, and a huge, like, star medallion. But just visually, that stuff is... It's so striking to me that it's... I don't know.
Right. It's a perfect, I don't know what you call it, like a... Not to get too Joseph Campbell about it, but like, just like this perfectly simplified mythological kind of thing. Like, yeah. here's Hades. He's mean. He lives underground. Here's Poseidon. He's weird. He lives in the ocean. Here's Dr. Ruby. He's evil, and so he just has like this very, you know, that red skin, which is obviously weird. And then the little weird skirt is more of a Star Trek-y kind of thing.
Well, he actually at least his head kind of came. I couldn't tell you the episode, but. There's an episode where they land on this planet, and there's kind of like a primitive race that has bright red skin and huge white afros, but they also have like antennas that connect them to, like, you know, their maker or something. I just thought, just visually, like, that looks great, you know, white hair and red skin.
Uh-huh.
And then, like, you know, it's almost like a Roman toga kind of look.
Okay.
That's perfectly acceptable on his planet.
Right, yeah. It looks as, well, from an American standpoint, it looks like a weird outfit. So he's obviously not from here. Not to get too off track, but were there a lot of Star Trek episodes where there was like a Roman thing going on in it, or am I just remembering wrong? Because it seems like I remember a lot of episodes where there was like some kind of Roman...
There's at least three. Well, there's the one with where the gladiators never really went out.
Okay.
You know, they're like broadcasting on television. There's one where Apollo's hand kind of came out of space and stopped the Enterprise.
Was it really Apollo?
Yeah, like the god Apollo.
Wow.
This big green hand that come and stopped the Enterprise. But,
wow.
Yeah, don't out me too much as a Trekkie, but...
Well, you don't know the episode numbers or anything. You don't know what star date it was when it happened.
No, and I'd like, if anybody knows how to interpret the star date from Next Generation, please tell me how that breaks down.
Yeah, you can email him, orionpax@gmail.com. So then you got, okay, so Dr. Ruby, he likes to make monsters. That's his deal, right? I mean, because for those of the listeners out there who want to know more about Galactic League of Marshals, there's actually a story out on your website, cbcomics.com. You can find the first episode that we co-created.
It'll be under the Mulligan's Run banner. It's the backup to that story.
Okay, yeah, and that was, what, six pages?
a very fruitful 6 pages.
Yeah, yeah. That deserves to be discussed as well. This question of, I remember when you approached me about it and what you were pitching to me about, at least like the tonal feel and the overall pace of the story. Why 6 pages? Why such a short little piece? Besides, you wanted to fill a couple pages in the for a backup feature, but I remember there was more to it than that. There was more of like a underlying philosophy of what you were aiming at with trying to belt out this quick little story.
Well, just trying to have a fully realized 6-page story. Well, basically, we kind of went the Stan Lee Jack Kirby route with the I kind of came up with a pitch and gave you kind of these pre-existing characters that didn't really have much going on. Besides visually what they look like and what you could extrapolate from looking at them, but just trying to come up with something like fast and loose, quick, concise, fun.
Did you
have something else that you're?
Oh well, I'm just trying to get at like what why you would want to do such short, fast, quickly put together stories as opposed to a more thoughtful, more rendered epic, kind of like the difference between, say, to go back to the old adventure serials, like the Crimson Ghost kind of stuff, versus like the latest, Angelina Jolie Tour de Force, where everybody's crying and everything, you know, all the camera shots are really slow and they pan over everything. And, yeah. Or like here we go, like a movie where that guy from Scrubs is in it, and then there's a lot of indie rock music playing, and like the camera slowly just pans around him while he looks at this guy kind of sad, and then maybe the guy from the Apple Buy a Mac commercials walks over and puts his arm around him, and then the guy from the OC who was also in Gilmore Girls walks up and they all walk off sad together, like a movie like that.
That's what I was going for, but then horribly wrong. So
by the way we just described a movie that would make $1 trillion. But why do something like the Crimson Ghost, or something like more like the 1960s kind of like the quick bang out, quick fast comics versus a more thought out epic. What is it that attracts you to that?
I mean, I guess a lot of it's economy of storytelling, like how much you can actually fit into 6 pages. Have a fully realized. I mean, that was the first time we ever met any of these characters.
Yeah,
we put them in. Some kind of conflict. We learn a little bit about each one of them, enough to where you'd want to, maybe read about them again, possibly. Just have it all kind of wrapped up with a little zing ending.
And it was definitely an interesting exercise to say, what can I say in one sentence about Captain Swift? What can I have him say in one sentence that's going to tell you everything you need to know about this guy?
Yeah.
I remember that was like the inspiration for the joke, where he says the Hawaiian Island planet, and and in that interchange with Eagle Eye's like, we're on Earth or in Earth orbit, you could just go to Hawaii, and he's like, nah, it's too touristy. You get a joke, which is a little haha, but you also get in the interchange, you learn a lot about the characters just with a couple lines.
Yeah, well, I think that's a testament to your ability.
Both of ours. I mean, I'm not trying.
That's something I'm still working on, struggling with a little bit. But
that's what I was kind of driving at, is this notion of through brevity, you're kind of you're forced to you've said this before. You should talk about it. This whole notion of putting limitations on work. The more you limit your work.
Oh yeah, I mean that's kind of, I guess that's kind of where we're coming from to begin with. The stories that this is kind of based on, or the feeling I'm trying to get, is from stuff that was done in the 60s that probably they did it in a week.
Right.
The entire thing start to finish to print in a week. And just to see what you can do, I think putting those limitations on yourself as far as either time frame or page number of pages, or limited color palettes, or any of that. So I think that can really, it goes with the television as well, or movies. With, you have a limited budget, you get more creative with what you can do. You look at, Evil Dead, the original Evil Dead, they had, a $15 budget, but what could they do with that? Camera trickery, you could do, maybe we can do this angle, or I just think putting those limitations on your project. I mean, it's a little bit different in comics, but it's the same kind of thing, is you can come up with a lot more creative answers to the questions that, you're kind of putting out for yourself there.
Yeah, the difference between, say, Dances with Wolves, where you can have, a 20-minute mood-setting scene. There's Kevin Costner sitting in a field of wheat for 20 minutes, And it's like, we can make this movie as long as we want. So if I want this scene to be as moody as I want it to be, I can make it this moody. Whereas if, you know, the art director comes in, he's like, you got 15 minutes to get this story really, you know, to sell this story, to get that across what happens. You are forced, you by not being able to do whatever you want, you know, by definition, you have to be more creative.
Yeah, the exact, the right moments to convey it in the quickest amount of time. And
right. So it's like getting to, again, to use an analogy that Hoover made, it's like the syrup, the Gatorade concentrate. You're trying to get all the flavor of the 32-ounce Gatorade into a spoonful, so you get the whole thing in one sip.
Yeah.
And how do you do that? You have to distill, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to, like, break down what's the most important, absolutely critical thing to happen in this piece. What's the one thing I can say that perfectly describes this character? There, I think, personally, there's, like, a real... a deep level of thought required to do that. Not to say that we're so deep and other people
but
are.
No, but I think, yeah, being able to boil it down to it's exactly what you need is way harder than being overindulgent and doing a 40-page comic about a guy walking around his living room.
I remember years ago, this is back in, like, 1998, I was having a discussion with Tom Root about... I was trying to coax him into co-writing the front with me. I was getting ready to do the retry doing the front. And Tom sat down with me and he said, okay, tell me about Hook. Tell me about the sword user. What's this guy's deal? And I hemmed and hawed for 25 minutes about, well, he's kind of like this and he's kind of like that and he's not this, but he is that. And it was clear to me and to Tom at that time that I really hadn't thought it through.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can give him, when you can give somebody a one or two sentence description, I think then it shows that you... This is like just general writing class stuff, isn't it? Where they say, like, give me a log line, give me a one sentence description of what this story's about. So I would
You really, like, hats off to the TV Guide guy that can come up with that very concise one sentence thing about, you know, the I Love Lucy show or whatever.
Right. So yeah, there you go. Is I would think that telling very short, complete stories, while it's not going to give you anything that's going to change your whole perspective, it's not going to be an Oprah book of the month, but there is a level of craftsmanship there.
For a creator, I think it's a really good exercise. It's really a difficult exercise to be able to do.
Right.
And my previous two things were between, like, you know, 50 and 60 pages each.
Right.
And I can't say that I really thought about, you know, economy of storytelling or, you know, any kind of, like, really boiling things down. That was more about mood and setup and, you know, trying to think... This way is totally different for me. I'm still kind of struggling with it myself.
Well, but that's cool that you bring that up because, yeah, Closing Doors and Say It and Slugs were both very much about mood, and that's perfectly legitimate as well. I mean, that's like just like it's just a different kind of story, right? I mean, it's not it's something we should really emphasize whenever we're talking about this kind of stuff because there's going to be people out there who start to get their hackles raised about, like, oh, these two smarties are telling me what kinds of stories are more valuable than others, and that's not the point.
It's all personal opinion.
Yeah, it's all personal opinion, and they're all just, you know, again, to use another corny analogy, the whole, you know, people in dark room with the elephant, everybody's touching a different part of the elephant kind of thing. So it's interesting that, you know, I never did any, like, true mood pieces. I've always been kind of in one direction with the whole humor and lightheartedness thing. But you have walked down a different road as a storyteller. You've gone down this very dark... I should emphasize to our listeners that Closing Doors and Say It and Slugs aren't necessarily all ages comics.
They're probably PG-13 to R.
Yeah.
There's no nudity, but there's some, you know, adult situation and language. But
so caution to parents that, yes... you know, there is some material that might not be suitable for children on Say It and Slugs and Closing Doors. But what's interesting about that is that they're both mood pieces over, say, plot pieces.
Oh, definitely over plot. The plot's kind of... It's almost like a film noir movie where the plot's kind of not...
Yeah.
It's not even really there. It's more just about how can we mess with this character and how can we put him in horrible situations that, you know, where the... You're basically messing with the guy so bad that the plot's kind of instant. It doesn't really matter, just how he ends up at the other end.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just put him through this ringer and see how he comes out on the other end.
So, yeah, so it's more of
that's more with Say It and Slugs, which is yet to be finished, but...
But, well, with Closing Doors, too, to a large degree. I mean, it's not so much about cause-and-effect plot or anything like that.
No.
It's more like, just like, here's this guy, and we see what his attitudes are, and then all this stuff is heaped on him, and how does he wind up at the end? And, like, the ending, I would say, isn't really necessarily, like, your standard Hollywood ending, either. It's not, it doesn't end on like a nice neat note. It's just like it's sort of like one of those endings where it's like, and so it goes on and on kind of thing.
Yeah, it's almost like, well, your cancer's in remission, but yeah, it might come back kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, who knows, this you know, I won't spoil the story if anybody's gonna read it, but it's basically, yeah, it's definitely not a bookend ending, or
right,
it's not the end. He the end with a question mark.
Right, yeah. He doesn't turn to the camera and say a little joke and everybody looks up at the sky and laughs.
Yeah, no winking at the end.
So, that's interesting. I mean, like, how would you describe, what do you think may be one of the bigger differences between, I'm not going to ask you which you prefer, obviously, mm-hmm. but what are the differences in the struggles? Because you just described what the struggles were of writing a concise story. What are the struggles with writing a big, you know, long-form, open-ended kind of thing?
I mean, basically, I just kind of came up with a theme, and that really was not plotted out or anything. That just kind of went as I, you know, drew it, came up with it as I went along. I had a rough idea of where I wanted it to end,
mm-hmm.
but I knew, like, my starting point, ending point, a couple things along the way, and I just kind of drew the line in between those all the way along.
Mm.
So it wasn't... It's almost kind of a sophomore-ish way to do it, I think. I like to try to be, you know, say that everything was completely planned out, but that was pretty much all based on instinct and, you know, feeling. I guess it kind of goes along with the theme of the story too. So I mean, I kind of made it in the way that I wanted that it was kind of going to come across in the end, anyways.
Well, I don't know if I'd call it sophomoric or anything, but it definitely seems more intuitive.
Yeah,
by comparison.
Yeah, that's probably a better word to use.
I would say, and you know, you can agree or disagree, but writing something like creating something, I should say, because mm-hmm. you're doing more than writing. You're writing with pictures, right? But creating something like Galactic League of Marshals would probably be more formulaic. You know, you got your high points, your low points, and especially if you're doing like a longer version, you do pictures, Act 1, 2, and 3. Whereas doing something like Say It in Slugs or Closing Doors, you're following your own intuition. You're kind of trusting that I'm going to get through this. I'm going to come up with ideas next week,
kind
of thing.
That was kind of the deal. I'm not... There's more weight on the characters' backs than, say, Galactic League, because with Galactic League, if some, you know, there's some downtime, hey, we can throw a huge planet-sized monster at them or whatever. I mean, visually, it's way more fun for me to do the sci-fi stuff, but, you know, having to draw a guy, you know, sitting in a record store for 50-some pages, that got really frustrating. Like, how can I possibly get the right camera angles where this isn't boring anymore?
Right.
How many more CDs can I draw? I mean, it's just like, how much this really needs to be seen, and I can't just do all close-ups.
But then the opposite end of the perspective on that is like, if you change the camera around too much, then it just starts looking like an art film. You know, you can't just constantly have the camera moving around. Like, I don't know if you remember that parody of the Money for Nothing video that Weird Al Yankovic did, where the camera was constantly changing, and he kept looking back and forth, kept trying to find the camera.
Keep up with it, yeah.
Yeah. So you don't want to do that either with your story. But yeah, there's like a very delicate balance, I imagine, you have to find when you're telling a more realistic...
Well, I ended up using a lot of flashback or talking about other characters, like, well, then we can kind of like... It's almost like the waking dream things that, you know, you see in television where... You know, somebody will be doing dishes, and all of a sudden, you know, like a mummy jumps through the window. But then, they're just daydreaming kind of thing.
Yeah.
So you can juxtapose the image of, you know, the guy doing whatever, and then like, you know, here's this new character that walks in. You know, do a little backstory on him, and gets out of that record store from it, and change of scenery.
Yeah, yeah. You've been definitely for those of you
two or three times.
for you older listeners out there, Closing Doors does have like some very interesting characters who show up in the form of customers at the record store.
And most of them are, you know, loosely based, or they're conglomerations of people that actually, you know, when I worked at a record store, these guys really existed. But most of them were much weirder than in the book. Much more interesting.
Well, that's another interesting point. I'm sure that writing Closing Doors, and to a degree Say It in Slugs, was probably much more drawn from your real life than, say, Galactic League.
I wish, yeah.
Okay, well, one last point that I guess we can cover just very briefly is, do you have a list of, you know, this is the oldest, corniest question in the world. This is almost as bad and unforgivable as what brought you into comics. But
what's your favorite comic book?
No, not that one. But your influences. What's the list if you go down like the top five guys who just I read their work once and I've been a quiver ever since, kind of thing.
A lot of it. I mean, it's going to probably fall more into artists than it is writers. But
yeah.
There's at least at the moment, there's Kirby, of course. There's Sal Buscema still.
Yeah,
John Buscema a little bit now, but I won't put him on the list. He'll just be kind of behind Sal. Simonson's still a lot. Oh, I'm gonna have to look at my stuff here.
Well, let me can you give me a why for each one? I mean, because like everybody, okay, saying that Jack Kirby's an influence amongst comic artists is kind of like saying be nice to people and don't tell lies,
exactly,
right?
Yeah.
But there is a reason. I mean, I'm sure you've got reasons why.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it, it's not. There's not probably that much actually his personal style, I guess, doesn't really reflect on me that much, but his imagination, how he could take an absolutely ridiculous idea like Devil Dinosaur and make it something that was interesting, like, that just blows me away. And his, like, just unbridled creativity for monsters and robots and spaceships and just, like, you see any of his technology, any of his monsters, like, in 1 second, that's his.
Yeah.
And kind of another thing of his, how he could extrapolate anatomy to where, you originally look at, like, say, like a biceps or like an arm, and to just somebody, that doesn't draw or is not as familiar with comics, you'd look at it and say, well, that's just kind of weird. Why did he put these weird lines on it?
Right.
And when you draw an arm over and over and over again, okay, that weird thing on the back of his arm, that's his tricep muscle.
Yeah.
And this is his bicep here, and this is part of, the another muscle. It's just, like, it's amazing how his, like, how he boiled that down into, like, it's almost like abstract.
Yeah.
it's really odd.
I forget who said it, but someone once compared him to, like, the Picasso of comics.
Yeah.
Where he's abstracted at that point. So it sounds like what you're saying is, like, you admire more of his philosophy rather than his technique.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
What his voice was.
Yeah, just like kind of like where he took things more than, trying to draw just like him, which is impossible and it looks ridiculous.
Well, there's some people who can channel Kirby very well.
I have channeled his noses. Mullins run. That's one thing I made an attempt to do.
But what about Simonson? What is it that...
Simonson has, like, I mean, he's kind of like, the second generation of Kirby as far as... okay, Kirby was dynamic, and Simonson's like, wow. Everything's exciting and explodes, Just his panel layouts and his, just the action he gets in figures, and,
Simonson, he does more with panel layout than Kirby did, I would say.
He does way more, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the only thing he really took from Kirby, I think, is maybe his, a little bit of, like, the technology bend on his things, and,
mm-hmm.
The action, and some of the shorthand for anatomy and things like that, I think he's lifted.
And the crazy foreshortening he'll do sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. That's his, some of that foreshortening, like Thor's leg coming at you, it's about, three times the size as the torso behind him. But
And a lot of times, like, his speed lines, like in that series he did for DC a couple years ago, Orion,
mm-hmm.
Remember the issue where he's fighting Darkseid?
Yeah.
Orion versus Darkseid for all the marbles.
Yeah.
And it's like, I think the entire issue is just sound effects, isn't it? Like, the last
panel.
Yeah,
it's all a fight. And, like, on the top and bottom, really narrow, thin panels are, like, the crowd watching.
Yeah.
Like, the reaction shots, which is, like, a great idea.
But I was just also thinking of the speed lines, how he used them as, like, also, he used them as a layout effect.
He
directs your eye with the speed lines, and the speed lines, is like, really take Kirby speed lines to a whole new dimension of... I remember I was talking with some school teachers, and I was using some pages from that issue as an example of iconic lines in comics that represent something that isn't there, right?
Yeah.
And, like, Darkseid's swooshing his hand in the air in a circular motion, and so, of course, Simonson's speed lines, like, form this donut around his arm.
Mm-hmm.
And it was difficult for some of the teachers to understand that those lines aren't actually there. They thought he was, like, making some kind of magical spell or something there, because they didn't know the story. But.
Yeah.
It's just interesting how they, like, take on a presence on the page, because his speed lines just go to such an extraordinary degree. And more so, even, I would say, than, like, in some ways, than manga speed lines. I would say, like, because speed lines figure in very prominently into manga.
And but they don't seem to necessarily interact with the figures as much as his, I don't think. But.
No, yeah, I would say, like, Simonson's become, like, very, like, abstract, very iconic, and...
That's one thing I struggle with as far as, like, trying, do I want to put... What kind of vocabulary do I want to use for speed lines or for, like, you know, if a guy's punching, is it just going to be a sound effect, or am I going to make the line?
Yeah.
How to integrate that, and Simonson does that, like, fantastically.
It looks effortless. Yeah.
Yeah, it totally blends in with his work, so.
Yeah, it makes me sick. So you said, then you said Sal Buscema, and what was interesting about what you said was you said, more so than John Buscema. Now, most people reverse that. Most people say Sal was the shadow of
they
John.
They think, yeah, the Sal's the hack.
Well, I don't know if they, I've never read that, but if people have said that, I wouldn't.
That's the derogatory, that'd be another episode. but John Buscema was, technically, he was a beautiful, beautiful penciler.
He's a beautiful man.
Beautiful man. Kind of a grumpy man.
By all accounts, a very grumpy man, but a wonderful artist.
Egotist, but yeah, he could draw Conan like nobody's business, or Silver Surfer, but I, to an extent, I think it's harder to get, to have a, to come up with an abstracted style like Sal's is. I really ain't, like, because you look at Sal's earlier stuff, and it's pretty close to his brother's. It's a little bit, it's not quite as rendered, it's not rendered quite as nicely and velvety as.
It's not as naturalistic.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it's a little more awkward, and he really, you know, sticks to certain conventions with, you know, punching people or screams. Like, he's got, like, the scream face he uses all
yeah,
the time.
Yeah, he does.
And lots of forehead wrinkles. And, but just, he could come up with a really compelling, like, he could draw anything in his style, and it works.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, it just, something drew me to his style more so than John's. Like, I appreciate John Buscema's style, but Sal's is, like, amped up more. It's more, it's not so, you know, super realistic. It's way more outside reality.
Yeah, it is more of an abstraction. And one of the things that I always think of when I look at the difference between Sal and John is, when you look at John Buscema's work, you think of, like, these graceful strokes with a brush on the page.
Yeah.
And everything's happening very smoothly and effortlessly. With Sal, I always imagine that the inking happens much more spastically.
Like, yeah.
Energizes, kind of just very zigzaggy kind of inking style, where he's just, like, every line I imagine he's going, yeah, 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 yeah. Whereas, yeah. Like, with John, it was always like, oh, yes, I am the master.
I don't know, Sal was also... he was kind of like the deadline guy too, like the go-to guy to get something done quick.
Yeah, wasn't he working on 4 books a month one time? Or no, am I thinking of Kirby?
I think that was Kirby. I think Buscema was doing. Was it in the '80s or nineties where he was doing like Avengers and Spectacular Spider-Man or something at the
something
same time?
Like that. 20 pages each or 22 pages each, and that's
and Spider-Man he's penciling and inking.
Yeah,
that blows my mind. But
yeah,
he took a lot of liberties, but it all works. It's all consistent.
So, and then you mentioned Kubert. Is Kubert more of, like you were saying in the beginning of this whole thing, like more about line than anything else then? Was that what attracted you?
Yeah, because as far as storytelling goes, he's pretty straightforward. He mm-hmm. he relies more on, like, what's in the frame than, you know, messing with the frame, I think, in the books. But a lot of his is just from a purely technical level as well. More so than... I mean, there's something really natural about Kubert's stuff, and there's something really... not nostalgic, but, you know, you look at some of his war comics and it just, like, rings so true. Like, nothing looks like it's... The stuff... It's not, well, like, it could... All the stuff could actually happen in reality, mm. I think. It's not like watching a war film, but it's, like, it's almost this idealized version of everything. For some reason, anytime he puts his, you know, his pen to paper, it's really compelling to me for some reason. I don't know if it's just his real honesty to his work or exactly what that is, but...
Well, yeah, like, that. Maybe that's a good way to put it. The honesty is, like, you never get a sense that Kubert's showing off. You never get a sense that Kubert's saying, like, look at me, look at what a fantastic artist I am. He's always doing just enough to get the picture...
Yeah, even, like, look at, like, Hawkman, some of that stuff, you know, from, like, the 60s.
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't as, like, fluid as some of the other artists, but this stuff is just, it's beautiful, really mood-setting. His camera angles are great. I mean, he'd usually stay within, you know, like, rectangular panels, but the way he'd, like, lay out people, you know, from the foreground, middle ground, background kind of things is, like, fantastic, like, storyboard kind of things. It reminded, like, really, like, film, I think, is how he staged his shots, but...
Well, what about, I know Larson was also a big influence on your stuff, in the 90s at least.
Yeah.
He started out, like, of any of the Image guys, he was the only one that I can, like, point to say, like, okay, well, that guy definitely...
I'd say his is almost like a philosophical
What do you mean?
Influence as well, as far as his... I mean, Savage Dragon is nothing more than what it is.
Okay.
It's, you know, it's just a bunch of guys beating each other up. I mean, he has, you know, doubleheader and just these absolutely ridiculous... Like, nothing is off the table with him. He has that kind of Kirby aesthetic as well with that. as far as his like artistic, there's not a whole lot of artistic influence anymore, I don't think. But
okay.
His, I'd love to have like a tenth of his energy.
Yeah.
But I do have his like how he, you know, he went on for years trying to do hand lettering, trying to like, keep a little bit of the old in with the new, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I can see that parallel between you and him, definitely. He embraces the computer, but at the same time tries to do with the computer what he originally did by hand. Like,
yeah.
Make it seem more, like,
yeah.
Authentically old-timey.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So, okay, well, I think that is as good of an introduction to your work as we're going to get for now. I'd like to encourage everyone to check out Mark's work both on SugaryCereals.com but also at CVComics.com. Again, disclaimer, not everything on CVComics.com is all ages friendly, although Mulligan's Run is designed for all ages,
mm-hmm.
as is Galactic League of Marshals. And I also want to encourage readers to visit the SugaryCereals.com site. If you have any questions for Mark, you can post them in our forum. And also, we'll be recording podcasts in the future where maybe we'll do some of the talk show ones where you can answer questions from readers directly. But
there'll be Twitter posts as well, right?
I'm not sure if there's going to be Twitter posts yet.
We'll edit that out.
but if there's a demand for Twitter posts, we can do that too. So, Mark, thanks for taking the time to talk about your thoughts.
No problem. So.
And that wraps up this week's episode of Saturday Supercast. Hope you had a good time. For more information on the stories we talked about, please visit SugaryCereals.com. And remember, Cereals is spelled S-E-R-I-A-L-S. The Sugary Cereals theme song is written and performed by Umberto, and you can find out more about them at virb.com/umberto. And, of course, Sugary Cereals is published by 01 Comics. You can find out more information on them at 01comics.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, bye.